Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 24th episode. Wild Trekker is a series of podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. This is the seventh episode of a seven-part series I call Dream World. This episode is devoted to magical realism, or the marvelous real, a genre of fiction developed particularly in Latin American countries. Many people say it started with the works of the Cuban author Alejo Carpentier in the mid-20th century. Carpentier himself traces it back to Franz Roux, a German artist in the 1920s. But anyway, magical realism then continued with the works of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Isabel Allende, and even Jorge Luis Borges and Ernesto Sabato. In the English-speaking world, a leading author of magical realist works is Salman Rushdie. Carpentier was born in Switzerland and later settled in Cuba. His starting point was European culture with its classical traditions of rationality, linear thinking, and the verbal representation of reality. Let's call this matter-of-fact reality the first dimension. Of course, Cuban culture is a unique blend of European, Afro-Caribbean, and even Amerindian traditions. So, on moving from Switzerland to Cuba, Carpentier was already dipping into the original blend of cultures that is Cuba. But then, in late 1945, Carpentier went on a trip to Haiti, which opened his eyes onto a second dimension. During that visit, he heard oral traditions steeped in what he calls lo real maravilloso, magical realism. And this was in a second dimension, quite distinct from the first. He was confronted on a daily basis with Haitians who believed in miracles, prodigies, shape-shifting, humans able to transform themselves into other animals. Carpentier met Haitians who could travel from physical to metaphysical space and back again. He listened to storytelling and voodoo drumming and witnessed collective singing and initiatory dancing. Carpentier met priests who invoked gods to possess and heal the faithful, to remedy whatever ailed them. Every step I took, Carpentier writes in his preface to El Reino de Este Mundo, The Kingdom of This World, I came across the marvelous real. Then I thought that the presence and relevance of the marvelous real was not a privilege only of Haiti, but rather a patrimony of all of the Americas. I have the impression that European culture had become for Carpentier something static, predictable, conventional, stripped of its original magical or incantatory characteristics. In latching onto the marvelous real, I wonder whether he was seeking some kind of escape from European culture, from himself, his education, his mindset. The marvelous real dimension of Haiti was very much alive, with its Afro-Caribbean origins and mythologies and magical chants and people falling into trances and becoming possessed and then communicating directly with the gods. So in his writing, Carpentier dipped into this other dimension. I would say not to appropriate the myths of another people, but rather to explore what it meant to shift from one dimension to another, catching a glimpse of that other magical space with its vast spiritual armies and presences. Remember one time on Baffin Island in the Canadian Arctic, I was staying with an Inuit family. My purpose was to write some newspaper stories there. To my surprise, the young man hosting me took me aside. He looked a little distracted, maybe even nervous. He was about to tell me something important, and he wasn't sure I was ready to believe him. "We know there are spirits on the land," he said. "They sometimes come up to your house. They're tiny. If you look at them without fear, they stay the way they are and won't trouble you. But if you're afraid, they grew up bigger than the house and they will endanger you." Many Inuit over the years have told me similar stories, and they've told and retold me legends of the shaman hero Kivyuk. Each time, they've had a faraway look in their eyes as if they were freeing themselves from matter-of-fact conventions by delving into age-old myth. It was a pleasure for them to tell me a familiar, defining story of the Inuit people. And what about the meeting point of two dimensions of reality? Is there such a place? To ponder this question, we need to step back from what is considered the largely Latin American literary phenomenon of magical realism. There have been, through the ages, many ways of picturing two or more parallel dimensions of reality. Consider the dawn of philosophy. Take, for example, in the 6th century BC, how Siddhartha awakens to the discovery that there are two truths, a truth of mundane conventions, what he called Samarviti Satya, and a truth of the ultimate Paramartha Satya. Ultimate truth frees us from the constraints of our concepts and conventions. According to a later tradition of Indian philosophy, mundane conventions are directly accessible, whereas ultimate truth is directly inaccessible. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy summarizes the view of the two truths taken by the Buddhist logician Dharmakirti in the 7th century AD. Of the two types of objects, he says, some are ultimately real, while others are only conventionally real, and some are not even conventionally real, they're just unreal or fictions. Dharmakirti here distinguishes between the ultimately real, the conventionally real, and the simply unreal. As a Buddhist gains in understanding over time, that means being able to discern between the ultimately real and the conventionally real, even to the point of letting go of the latter. Many other philosophical and religious traditions draw similar distinctions. The idea of shifting from rationality, linear thinking, and the verbal representation of reality from a dimension of conventions and outer appearances to the ultimate dimension, or simply to unreal fictions, is not unique to Latin American magical realism. Far from it. Nor is the idea of living in a world with multiple dimensions. Then again, world literature offers many examples of characters on a quest for true knowledge, unsure whether they are in a first, inner reality of conventions, or are instead unwillingly exploring a second inner reality of demonic fantasy. Jean Potocki was a strange figure, a bundle of contradictions from the late 18th, early 19th century. He was a wandering scholar, a scientist after a fashion, and a remarkable author of fantastic literature. A count from one of Poland's most powerful families, he was fluent in French, yet barely capable of speaking Polish. He lived off the income from his estate and 5,000 serfs at Uwadówka, in what is now west-central Ukraine, while advocating greater liberties. He upheld Polish nationhood up till the final partition of 1795, then became staunchly pro-Russian to the point of drafting strategies for Imperial Russia's expansion across southern and eastern Asia. He pursued a program of rational research while filling his fiction with ghosts, demons, corpses, debauched sirens, vampires, bandits, hooded inquisitors, and scenes of shuddering frenzy in underground pleasure palaces, stables, wayside inns, torture chambers, as well as beneath gallows, on battlefields, and during long rambles on horseback. The most interesting of Potocki's works is without doubt Manuscrit trouvé à Saragosse. This novel is never associated with magical realism, although the late Bulgarian-French literary critic Svetan Todorov considered it a great work of fantastic literature. I'm not going to retell tales already told and retold by Potocki, but I will mention a few aspects of the novel. The manuscript tells the story of Alphonse van Worden, who chances across a leather-bound esoteric volume during a battle in Spain. He believes the manuscript holds the key to his destiny. By turns picaresque and occult, this frame-tailed novel containing stories within stories, spread over 66 days, sees Van Vorden drawn into a troubling but gratifying relationship with two Tunisian princesses, and also sisters, Emina and Zubeda. He often finds himself sharing nights of passion with them both. These sexual encounters are implied rather than described explicitly. The narrative is full of shimmering, trembling imagery and characters changing identities before our eyes. The theme of a man enjoying the sexual favors of two women at the same time is repeated throughout the novel, for example, with Camilla and Inesilla, then the gypsy chief's two unnamed daughters, then Antonia and Marita, then Kita and Zita, and finally, the Duchess of Avila and her purported sister, Leonor, who's really the Duchess herself in disguise. Each story is told by a different character, but it eventually becomes clear that the stories are often one and the same, and are being retold from a new perspective, like characters facing every which way in a Cubist painting. Van Vorden's two female lovers often turn out to be demons playing tricks on him. This is one of the most striking features of the manuscript. Van Vorden, like Potocki, is a wandering scholar. He's on an existential quest, knows moments of angst, not to mention sheer horror, is drawn constantly into new situations, and understands nothing. The novel is located in a kind of dreamland between Judaism, Catholicism, Islam, and pagan culture, flipping from one tradition to the next as the characters deceive, seduce, betray, and occasionally get to know one another. Death is ever present in the novel, and Van Vorden seems obsessed by it. Perhaps the most interesting feature of the manuscript is the way reality is contrasted with ghostly apparitions, delusions, paranoid frenzy, the way ineffectual, self-defeating noblemen remain loyal to lost causes like honor, yet, along the way, discover their own shifting loyalties and incestuous family secrets. It's a novel of ambiguity, ambivalence, shattered identities. I've taken a bit of a digression from magical realism through the philosophy of ancient India to fantastic literature. Jean Potocki evokes the feverish, agitated shifting of his characters between different dimensions of inner reality. Okay, now back to magical realism in Latin America. It strikes me that magical realism comes in many forms. There are novels like Carpentier's The Kingdom of the World, which depict slave revolts. Carpentier's Explosion in a Cathedral, depicting a confiscated revolution. Sprawling family chronicles like Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Cien Años de Soledad, or 100 Years of Solitude, and the dark obsessions of a deranged artist, like Ernesto Sabato's The Tunnel. Alejo Carpentier considers the marvelous real to be grounded in the Baroque. Academicism, he writes, is characteristic of settled times that are complete, sure of themselves. The Baroque, on the other hand, arises where there is transformation, mutation, or innovation. The Baroque always projects forward and tends, in fact, to a phase of expansion at the culminating moment of a civilization or when a new social order is about to be born. It can be a culmination, just as it can be a premonition. America, a continent of symbiosis, mutations, vibrations, mestizaje, has always been Barak. Now, the Barak, to me, is crowded, dense, florid, layered, excessive, irregular, confusing, certainly hard to digest, crammed full of bizarre, ornate patterns. But this is not what Carpentier means by Barak. He's referring instead to the existence in Latin America of a reality which is so new that it leaves you speechless. First of all, says Carpentier, the conquistadors of the 16th century reached a continent whose nature and enormous imperial cities simply defied description. There were no words, there was no vocabulary to evoke what they saw and experienced. He quotes Bernal Diaz on visiting Tenochtitlan, or Mexico City, for the first time. We were all amazed, and we said that these lands, temples, and lakes were like the enchantments in the Book of Amadis, that is, in a late medieval romance of chivalry, full of fantastic adventures, magical powers, prophecy, madness, and horrible monsters. So Bernal Diaz could only picture this marvelous world to himself by comparing it to medieval European legends of the marvelous. This reminds me of what Edmund Burke and Immanuel Kant wrote in the 18th century about the sublime. Finding himself in the presence of the sublime did not prevent Bernal Diaz from drawing his sword and cutting down as many Aztecs as he possibly could. In other passages, Diaz describes ritual sacrifice, cannibalism, and the 119 battles in which he took part, helping to defeat the Aztec Empire. Carpentier then goes on to say, dictionaries tell us that the marvelous is something that causes admiration because it is extraordinary, excellent, formidable, and that is joined to the notion that everything marvelous must be beautiful, lovely, pleasant, when really the only thing that should be gleaned from the dictionary is a reference to the extraordinary. The extraordinary is not necessarily lovely or beautiful. It's neither beautiful nor ugly. Rather, it is amazing because it is strange. Everything strange, everything amazing, everything that eludes established norms is marvelous. Carpentier develops a Baroque writing style, which springs directly from the lush tropical landscape and métissage, or the blending of cultures. And this writing style is warm, green, vital. In writing of François Macandal, a leading character in the Kingdom of the World, Carpentier says, Macandal's revolt, which makes thousands and thousands of slaves in Haiti believe that he can change into a bird, or a horse, a butterfly, an insect, whatever his heart desires. So he foments one of the first authentic revolutions of the New World. Carpentier goes on to say, if our duty is to depict this world, we must uncover and interpret it ourselves. Our reality will appear new to our eyes. Description is inescapable, and the description of a Baroque world is necessarily Baroque. That is, in this case, the what and the how coincide in a Baroque reality. I have to create with my words a Baroque style that parallels the Baroque of the temperate, tropical landscape. While I really like Alejo Carpentier's writings, I find a problem with his concept of the marvelous real. In his view, all roads of invention inevitably refer back to the constraints of conventional European rationality, and the sheer weight of history, for example, the mass destruction wrought in the New World by the conquistadors. And while acknowledging this difficult legacy, which strikes me as a kind of mental or cultural shackle, Carpentier does his best to remove the shackle. He seems to me in the either-or mode. Either he's with European rationality and conquest, or he's reacting to it by building a framework of métissage. Aleixo Carpentier has articulated a whole theory, if you like, of magical realism, but I find something different there. I find, in magical realism, rhythms, repetitions, the secret inner spark or impetus or voice pushing people along towards their destiny. I find word pictures rather than flat descriptions, societies in motion, a fierce beauty in the love between man and woman. I find storylines, characters, scenes, and actions that are fluid, like the endlessly changing currents of streams and rivers passing through the forest. I find family chronicles like immense tapestries with an enormous number of characters whose importance may not lie in what they experience themselves individually, but rather in the way they are all connected together, repeating the same patterns of behavior over and over. I find magic springing from reality, and in magical realism, I accept that the real that we perceive is itself magical. I see five defining characteristics of magical realism. First, in the marvelous real, magic is spontaneous. It grows out of, surges forth from, the real, like dreams springing out of our everyday life, like the profusion of tree trunks and branches invading every space in the ruins of an old colonial building. I remember visiting an abandoned penal colony once on Royal Island off the shores of French Guiana, just next to Devil's Island. Trees had invaded every nook and cranny of the building, driving through walls, coiling around doorways, running here and there, blasting their way through the roof. Tree trunks had taken the place of the convicts. This scene seemed like the revenge of nature on human cruelty. Or perhaps, instead, it was simply nature, now reawakened and unleashed, demanding its rightful place and spontaneously demonstrating it could obliterate any trace of humanity. Second, the marvelous real treats the conventional real merely as a point of departure on a long journey back to ancient truths and beliefs. Third, the marvelous real thrives on metamorphosis, reversals, and shape-shifting. In this sense, it's like variations on a theme in jazz. Fourth, the marvelous real is a repudiation of the conventionally real, which comes back to repudiating structures of power, rationality, the dominant discourse. In this other secret dimension, simple people, largely in rural settings, seek freedom. Fifth, the marvelous real exists in a societal context and promotes political emancipation, particularly of disenfranchised people in rural settings. In the Latin American context, the marvelous real must also have served as a way of getting around censorship by disguising criticism of power. I like Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. In this novel, published in 1967, Garcia Marquez weaves a chronicle of the Buendia family, whose founder created the town of Macondo near the north coast of the author's native country, Colombia. From the very opening sentence, this extraordinary multi-generational chronicle casts a spell on the reader. Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. The novel recounts seven generations of the Buendia family, their joys, sorrows, epic loves, inspiring beauties, dreams, and incestuous desires. In the story, a local community grows up in Macondo around the family, and this community is eventually subjected to the growth of liberal political ideas in the 19th century, the futile ballet of armies and rebels sweeping back and forth during the Thousand Days War, the impact of a centralizing national government, and the introduction of railways, steam technology, and American capitalism, plus massacres of striking workers. In this extraordinary novel, the private dream world and mythologies of the characters play out across an entire century as they come up against naked, arbitrary power. The author explores the role of family memory transmitted from one generation to the next, and the tone is by turns tragic, comic, absurd, and gloomy, as if time were circular and the same events were doomed to be repeated over and over again. As Garcia Marquez writes in the concluding passage, before reaching the final line, however, he'd already understood that he would never leave that room, for it was foreseen that the city of mirrors, or mirages, would be wiped out by the wind and exiled from the memory of men at the precise moment when Aureliano Babilonia would finish deciphering the parchments, and that everything written on them was unrepeatable since time immemorial and forevermore, because races condemned to 100 years of solitude did not have a second opportunity on Earth. Which is like saying the real, lived experience of the Buendia family withdraws from conventional reality and moves into an ambiguous space of forgotten memories or delusions. But another passage speaks to me more directly because it comes back to the spark, the impetus driving life along, but also death. I mentioned this earlier. A trickle of blood came out under the door, crossed the living room, went out into the street, continued on in a straight line across the uneven terraces, went down steps and climbed over curbs, passed along the street of the Turks, turned a corner to the right and another to the left, made a right angle at the Buendia house, went in under the closed door, crossed through the parlor, hugging the walls so as not to stain the rugs, went on to the other living room, made a wide curve to avoid the dining room table, went along the porch with the begonias, and passed, without being seen, under Amaranta's chair as she gave an arithmetic lesson to Aureliano José, and went through the pantry and came out in the kitchen, where Ursula was getting ready to crack 36 eggs to make bread. So is magical realism, or lo real maravilloso, really a Latin American phenomenon? Not necessarily. Consider what the Chilean novelist Isabel Allende said in an interview in 1991. Magic realism is a literary device or a way of seeing in which there is space for the invisible forces that move the world. Dreams, legends, myths, emotion, passion, history. All of these forces find a place in the absurd, unexplainable aspects of magic realism. Magic realism is all over the world. It is the capacity to see and to write about all the dimensions of reality. I remember being visited once, in a dream, by none other than Alfred Hitchcock, who had come to explain to me how to complete my film, The Blinding Sea. Okay, I'd like to reiterate this was a dream, so an involuntary experience. However, as soon as I woke up, I reached for a notebook and started taking notes. Your story should be pushed along by elemental emotions, Hitchcock told me in this dream. Excitement, love, desire, fear, hatred, hunger, disgust, terror, thirst, pride, shame. Hitchcock was telling me that elemental emotions are the very essence of a good film. The same is true of magical realism, and this brings me to my last point. Magical realism, in shifting from a conventional, matter-of-fact kind of reality to an inner reality, springing forth spontaneously from nature, thrives on elemental emotions. There's nothing abstract about it. As we move through life, our perspective changes. One and the same experience seems very different to us, as we live it at the moment. Recall the experience shortly afterwards, relive it later on in our dreams or fantasies, then call to mind the experience much later, as if it were gradually withdrawing into the background. On the other hand, I find that love, emotions, and values take their place in the forefront of our lives as we move along. Words fail, but symbols live on in that inner space we all have of hopes and urges and dreams. The magic of writing or filming creative works is to bring alive that secret inner spark or impetus or voice that pushes us along towards our destiny. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net, and Evidencia is spelled with the letter N as in November. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeules on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020 George Toombs. All rights reserved.